they won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, United States officials are working with Haitian officials to try to secure the release of 12 adults and 5 children with a U.S.-based religious group. All were taken over the weekend by members of a criminal group known for killings and kidnappings. The 16 Americans and 1 Canadian are with Christian Aid Ministries. They were taken by a group called 400 Mawozo. The gang controls the Kwadebuke area east of the capital, Port-au-Prince, said a police official. The kidnapping happened Saturday in the community of Gontier, which lies in the gang's area. As officials sought the release of the 17 people, local unions and other organizations were set to launch a strike Monday to protest Haiti's worsening security situation. Haiti is again struggling with a rise in gang-related kidnappings, which had lessened in recent months. The rise in such crimes follows the murder of President Jovenel Moïse on July 7th and a powerful earthquake that killed more than 2,200 people in August. Everyone is concerned. They're kidnapping from all social classes, said Mehu Chanjou. He is president of Haiti's Association of Owners and Drivers. He spoke on Haiti's Magic 9 radio station. He said the worker strike would continue until the government could guarantee people's safety. The kidnapping of the missionaries came just days after high-level U.S. officials visited Haiti and promised more resources for Haiti's national police. The U.S. State Department said Sunday that it was in communication with senior Haitian officials and would continue to work with them and other partners. The welfare and safety of U.S. citizens abroad is one of the highest priorities of the Department of State, the agency said in a statement. Christian Aid Ministry said the kidnapped group included 7 women, 5 men, and 5 children, including a 2-year-old. The organization said the group was taken while on a trip to visit an orphanage, a home for children who do not have living parents. Christian Aid Ministries said in a statement, "As an organization, we commit this situation to God and trust Him to see us through." A yearly report published last year by Christian Aid Ministries said its American workers had returned to their base in Haiti after a 9-month break due to political unrest. It noted the difficulties that come from such unrest. Nearly a year ago, Haitian police publicly sought the supposed leader of the 400 Mawozo gang, Wilson Joseph. The police planned to charge him with murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, car stealing, and the hijacking of trucks carrying goods. Joseph also goes by the name of Lamo Sanjo, which means death doesn't know which day it's coming. As kidnapping cases rise, gangs have demanded money in exchange for a person's return. The gangs have at times asked for more than $1 million. Sometimes they kill those they have kidnapped, officials report. At least 328 kidnappings were reported to Haiti's national police in the first 8 months of 2021, compared with a total of 234 for all of 2020. Those numbers come from the United Nations Integrated Office in Haiti. Gangs have been accused of kidnapping school children, doctors, police officers, bus passengers, and others as they grow more powerful. In April, a man who claimed to be the leader of 400 Mawozo told a radio station that the gang was responsible for kidnapping 5 priests, 2 nuns, and 3 family members of one of the priests that month. The people were later released. The increase in kidnappings and gang-related violence has forced Haitians to avoid some gang-controlled areas. Others choose to stay home. This, in turn, means less money for people like Charles Pierre. He is a moto taxi driver in Port-au-Prince. He has several children to feed. "People are not going out in the streets," he said. "We cannot find people to transport."
Nobody ever said gardening offers immediate results. That is what Lee Reich warns in his latest report in a series for the Associated Press about gardening. With this limitation in mind, he dug up one of his flower beds recently. For plants, autumn is a good time for a flower bed makeover. A makeover changes the appearance of something almost completely, so it looks a lot better. During the autumn, cooler temperatures slow water loss from leaves. This means that plants can better deal with being taken out of the ground and roughed up before having their roots placed back into the soil. Leaves help support new root growth, helping the plants reestablish themselves in their new homes. However, if you gave most plants this kind of rough treatment in the summer, most would die. The major reason for Reich's flower bed makeover was some Siberian irises that had grown wildly. They threatened to take over the whole bed. It might be that you cannot have too many iris flowers, but after the flowers disappear, you surely can have too many iris leaves. His were taking up space where other later flowering plants could be beautifying the garden. The same could be said for the daffodils in that bed. Both irises and daffodils grow from round bulbs. They found the bed much to their liking and created many more bulbs year after year. They presented a glorious and welcome sea of yellow each spring, but the yellowing leaves that followed were a sorry sight for too long. At least the iris leaves looked orderly the whole season. Autumn is also a good time for a flower bed makeover. That is because any planting mistakes, lack of midsummer flowers, poor color combinations, or too many irises and daffodils are still fresh in mind. In addition, Reisha's bed suffered from becoming too much of a disordered mix of flowering plants. It had become a home, although it was supposed to be only a temporary one, for many flowers that he had been given or had bought without any thought. Diving into this chance to redo the whole flower garden, Reisha made a plan on paper. A good idea is to draw a bird's-eye view of what the garden should look like from above. This shows where in the garden each of the flowers should be planted. But also draw a human's-eye view, that is, the garden as you would see it from ground level. In this human's-eye view, Reisha was able to imagine a pleasant mixture of irises, delphiniums, and gay feathers, asters, spiraeas, and black-eyed Susans, including a butterfly bush and baby's breath flowers, would, Reisha hoped, bring everything together. Then the actual work began. To thin out plants like irises, he used a garden tool to dig beneath the thick group of plants and lift them out. Once out of the ground, he cut the group down the center and pulled it apart. He replanted parts of the clump and gave away the rest to a fellow gardener for planting. And the daffodils? He just dug them up, separated the bulbs by hand, and replanted the largest ones. Reisha watered everything well to make certain that the roots started to grow as soon as possible. After that, he put about 5 centimeters of small wood pieces, or chips, over everything, except for the delphiniums. He added compost before putting the chips around those plants because they need fertile soil to grow. Wood chips are a kind of mulch or soil covering that keep the soil from drying out. It also keeps soil temperatures from dropping as low in the winter or changing too fast. That means mulch gives roots more time to grow before temperatures start to freeze. And it prevents freezing conditions from pushing new plants out of the ground. For gardeners, there is a downside to autumn flower bed makeovers. The bed looks a little forlorn from the autumn through the winter because you have dug it up and the plants are not ready to grow. But everything will look fresh in the spring. Yes, it is true gardeners can wait until spring for a makeover. But there are many other things to attend to in the spring garden. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Throughout most of the 1850s, war was a continual threat between the North and the South over the issue of slavery. Then, in the autumn of 1859, the crisis seemed to calm. Anti-slavery extremists governed only a few states of the North, and pro-slavery extremists held power in only a few states of the Deep South. There had been elections in most of the Northern and Southern states. Voters had rejected candidates with extremist ideas and elected moderates instead. The public saw the elections as a sign of hope that reasonable people might find a way to settle the bitter dispute over slavery. But these hopes fell apart on October 17, 1859. That day brought the news that a group of abolitionists had attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. The town was then part of Virginia. Today, it is part of West Virginia. Now, Jack Moyles and Harry Monroe continue our story.
The attack was led by John Brown, an old anti-slavery extremist. Many believed him insane. He had gone to Kansas and fought bitterly against pro-slavery forces. Once, to answer an attack on the town of Lawrence, Brown and his men pulled 5 men and boys from their homes and murdered them. The wife of one of the men said Brown told her, "If a man stands between me and what I believe to be right, I will take his life as coolly as I would eat my breakfast." Brown lost a son in a pro-slavery attack on his home at Osawatomie, Kansas. Brown and his friends were forced to flee. They watched as the pro-slavery men burned the town. Brown shook with grief and anger. "I have only a short time to live," he said, "only one death to die, and I will die fighting for this cause. There will be no more peace in this land until slavery is done for. I will give them something else to do than to extend slave territory. I will carry this war into the South."
To fight a war against slavery, Brown needed money and guns. He went to Massachusetts and New York. He spoke at town meetings and met privately with abolitionist leaders. In these private talks, Brown said it was too late to settle the slave question through politics or any other peaceful way. He said the only answer was a slave rebellion. It would be bloody, Brown said, and this was terrible. But slavery itself was a terrible wrong, the same as murder. Only blood, he said, would wash away the wrongs of slavery. Brown said God meant for him to begin this rebellion by invading Virginia with a military force he already was organizing. Brown said even if the rebellion failed, it would probably lead to a civil war between North and South. In such a war, he said, the North would break the chains of the black man on the battlefield.
Brown won the support of a group of abolitionist leaders. They formed a secret committee and called themselves the Secret Six. They agreed to advise Brown and, more importantly, to raise $1,000 for him. From New England, Brown went to Chatham, Canada. He went there for a secret convention he had called to form a revolutionary government. This government would rule all the slave territory that Brown and his men could capture. 46 representatives went to the convention, 34 Negroes and 12 whites. Brown told them of his plan. He said he was sure that Southern slaves were ready for rebellion. He said they would rise up at the first sign of a leader who wished to break their chains.
But what if troops are brought against you? One man asked. Brown answered that his men would fight in the mountains, where a small force could stop a much larger one. He said his men would be well trained in mountain fighting. Brown said he expected his small force to grow much larger. He would invite the slaves he freed to join his army. And he said he thought that all the free Negroes of the North would come to fight slavery with him. The representatives approved Brown's constitution, and they named him commander-in-chief.
Brown had decided to strike at Harper's Ferry, a town of about 2,500 people. It was in northern Virginia, about 100 kilometers north of Washington. Harper's Ferry was built on a narrow finger of land where the Shenandoah River flowed into the Potomac River. There were two bridges. One crossed the Shenandoah. The other, a railroad bridge, crossed the Potomac to Maryland. John Brown chose Harper's Ferry because there was a factory there that made guns for the army. There also was an arsenal where several $1 million worth of military equipment was kept. Brown needed the guns and equipment for the slave army he hoped to form.
Old Brown arrived at Harper's Ferry early in July 1859. Two of his sons, Owen and Oliver, and another man came with him. They rented an old house on a farm in Maryland, not far from Harper's Ferry. Brown told people that he was a cattle buyer from New York. Brown's men joined him, one or two at a time, over the next several months. They traveled at night, so no one would see them. Once they reached the farmhouse, they had to stay in hiding. Week by week, the little force grew. But it grew too slowly. By the end of summer, there were still less than 20 men hiding in the old house. Brown wrote letters to his supporters in the north. He asked for more money and more men. He got little of either. His supporters were afraid. Too many people knew of Brown's plans. The Secret Six feared they would face criminal charges if Brown attacked Harper's Ferry. Brown's men grew tired of the small, crowded rooms of the farmhouse. Brown knew he must act soon, or his young men would begin leaving.
On Saturday, October 15th, three men arrived to join the group. One of them brought $600 in gold for Brown's use. Brown saw the gold as a sign that God wanted him to act. He told his men they would strike the next night. Brown held religious services Sunday morning and prayed for God to help him free the slaves. Then he called his men around him to explain to them his battle plan. They would seize the two bridges at Harper's Ferry and close them. Next, they would capture the armory and the rifle factory. They would capture as many people as possible. They would use the people as hostages for protection against any soldiers that might be sent against them.
The army had no men near Harper's Ferry. Brown believed he would have all the time he needed. He believed his only opposition might be local groups of militia. He did not fear these civilian soldiers. The old man thought he and his men could hold Harper's Ferry until slaves in the area rebelled and joined them. Brown knew that Maryland and Western Virginia were full of people opposed to slavery. He expected many of them to come to his aid. The 22 men rested until dark, listening to rain hit the roof of the farmhouse.
About 8 o'clock, Brown called his group. "Men," he said, "get your weapons. We are going to the ferry." A wagon was brought out and a horse tied to it. In the wagon were a few tools and some extra guns. Brown climbed into the wagon and started it toward town. Two of his men stepped out in front of the wagon, leading the way. The others walked behind. It was a dark and cold night. A light rain was falling. There was no one else on the road. After a time, they reached the high ground above the Potomac. Below them, across the river, lay the town of Harper's Ferry. Most of the town was sleeping. Only a few lights shone through the rain. John Brown was ready for his final struggle against slavery.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.